When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Dr. Klaus Puntapanon, welcome back to the program.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Klaus, it exceeded my expectations. I expected beautiful images, but I was blown away. I was just absolutely amazed. And this telescope is just better than expected. Within these images that have been released over the last few days, what really surprised you as a scientist working with this telescope?
I think there's several things that surprised me. I think one of the first things that really came out was in the deep field, the one that was released a day early by the president. We knew that we would have a deep field. We knew that we would be, about the same depth as the deepest fields Hubble did. At least that's how it was designed. What we didn't know was, well, for one thing is the observatory is better than expected. And so that means that we're now deeper than anything that's been done before. But it was a bit of a bonus. That was not the expectation. But the other thing is just this incredible detail and the high resolution of the image that allows us to see these distant galaxies as not just smudges, but entities, like individual creatures with structures. So if you zoom in on some of the galaxies in the deep field, you see these that some of them are surrounded by these little dots, and these are, we think, are individual star forming clusters within the galaxies that Hubble just could never saw. And I think there's some real science there. I mean, this all has to be analyzed in the coming weeks and months by experts in this field, but on our team, the galaxy experts, they were looking at this and they said, we've never seen this before. There are some models that might predict that these early galaxies, if they should form lots of these star clusters, but now we see them in this amazing detail. And I think some of this comes from the fact that the observatory is actually sharper than was expected at the shortest wavelength, down at about 1 micron, and that's where you really see all those little blobs come up. So that really surprised me how many details we actually could see.
Were you able to determine in the deep field image, and I know it's early to ask this question, but how far back are we looking? I mean, what is roughly the most distant galaxy in light years that we're seeing in that image?
So, yeah, we were able to determine I wouldn't say distance, more the age of the light. Because this is the thing with these kind of cosmological distances. The universe is expanding, right? So, long time in the past, these galaxies emitted some light, and this light has traveled to us. But in the meantime, as this light travels through the universe for billions of years before it reaches us, the galaxy that emitted that light has moved away, because it's moved along with the universe. So the galaxies today are much farther away than they were when they emitted that light. So usually we think of distances in terms of what we call look-back time. So it's rather the time that the light has traveled, the age of the light, and that we can measure very precisely. And we actually did this as part of this release using spectroscopy, right? So the method where you take the light from these distant galaxies and you spread it out into its individual colors, and it turns out that when these galaxies are very young and they actively form lots of stars, they have very specific colors they emit, because specific elements emit light in specific colors. So these are called lines. And there's a product in there that shows how this works. So we measured it very precisely. And I'm sure there are probably galaxies that are even more distant than the ones we found. But the most distant ones that we looked at was more than 13 billion years old. The light has traveled for more than 13 billion years, 13.1 to be exact.
Now, when you look at a galaxy like that and you look at its spectra, do you just simply see the expected lesser amounts of other elements and you just see more hydrogen and helium and a little bit of lithium? Can you profile it that way? I mean, can you see the progress of the aftermath of the Big Bang as far as elemental formation in these galaxies?
Yeah, you can. Well, now we can. We couldn't before. So that's another thing we found out, is that the quality of the spectra is really amazing. I know, you know, people look at spectra and it's not as beautiful as the images, but to an astronomer, it's the most beautiful thing, because you can just look at the spectrum and you immediately know something very quantitative about the object. And one of the things that we can do, and that we will do, the folks who are working on this will do over the following months, is do exactly that, measure how many heavy elements there are in this galaxy. So the hydrogen and the helium that was formed in the Big Bang, and a bit of lithium. But we detected neon and oxygen in these galaxies, and that has been formed by stars, by some later generation of stars. And one of the things that folks will definitely look for is if there's less of that, what you call lower metallicity, in the oldest galaxies, to see if they're essentially more primitive or they look like they only had maybe a couple of generations of stars. And then ultimately, with even deeper fields, we'll look for areas where there's essentially no heavy elements.
Now, within an image like this, you know, obviously you have very, very marked gravitational lensing going on. And that's interesting, because sometimes you can discover individual stars. I believe Arundel is the most distant star we've ever seen, because it's gravitationally lensed from another galaxy that's very distant. Can we do that with this? I mean, can we study an individual star as opposed to a galaxy as a whole using spectra?
Yeah, I mean, Hubble, if Hubble can do it, Webb can certainly do it better. Absolutely. It's a rare event, though, because that individual star has to be aligned extremely well in a certain configuration within the lens to be magnified by, I think the Arundel one was claimed to be magnified by 1,000 times or more. So that's a very sort of precise chance alignment. But yeah, sure. And we see significant enhancements in the galaxies that are in this field by that gravitational lens. I think and you see a lot of dots in the galaxies that you might think are stars. I'm guessing most of them are not individual stars, but star clusters in the galaxy. And what it then comes down to is, again, you have to go and take a spectrum of the object to figure out if it is an individual star, if it's a whole star cluster. But Webb has this amazing sensitivity to take these spectra. And I think it's one of the things that people will realize, that this ability to go back and measure with such great precision what's actually there, not just from the image, but from spectra, is something that's really going to blow people's minds as we go down the line.
Now, regarding spectra, it's not just galaxies. We also have characterized water vapor in the atmosphere of an exoplanet, a sort of vaguely Saturn-like gas giant, but there is water vapor, and that heralds what we can do with perhaps rocky exoplanets looking for water vapor in their atmospheres. And if we can do that, then, you know, you're moving the territory of looking for life. When is that going to start? I mean, what on the exoplanet side, when are we going to see news of the next characterization of an exoplanet atmosphere?
So I can't say when there's going to be another news item at this time, but I certainly can say that there are already observations taken for scientists of other exoplanets in this way. And there are a lot of them lined up in the next year. So I don't think it's going to be long, but, you know, I haven't seen any results yet, so I can't say.
Now, what's that look like? I mean, how many observations, individual observations for scientists is Webb doing right now? You know, I mean, how many per day does it accomplish? Or is it just a completely random number that just depends on how much observing time is required?
Yeah, I mean, it really varies depending on what is being done. But let's say a typical what we call a visit, which is where the observatory goes and looks at a certain object without going to another one, and an observing program or an experiment. It can be many of those visits, but a typical one like that is maybe a few hours, from somewhere from between 1 hour and 5 hours. So you can divide 24 hours into that, and so you'd get maybe, you know, between 5 and 10 ish programs over a 24-hour period that has some observations taken.
Now, did the deep field take quite a bit longer to accomplish?
Well, it's one of the things about the deep field is that it was done so quickly. I think everybody's really amazed by how quickly we beat records. It was you'll see different numbers in the literature because there's sort of different ways to skin this cat. So on the clock, that image, the NearCam image, was done on the clock in just over 6 hours of exposure time, just integrating on it, just over 6 hours.
That's amazing.
Yeah. So sometimes you'll see 12 hours mentioned, and this comes back to what I mentioned before. There's a lot of multiplexing in NearCam. So not only does NearCam have these two different cameras that sit next to each other, each individual one of those cameras actually also observes two different filters at the same time. So it observes two different colors of light at the same time of the same field. So in terms of depth, it corresponds, and Hubble can only do one at a time, right? So in terms of depth, it's like 12 hours, but on the clock, it's only six, if that makes sense.
A faster observation. But then again, JWST is far newer than Hubble. You know, Hubble's 1980s technology that's somewhat upgraded, but we haven't been there in a to visit in a you know years. Now, the micrometeoroid impact on JWST, which almost destroyed me when I heard about it. How bad is that? And is it just something that you just have to shrug and expect? And could it happen again to that level? I know things get hit by micrometeoroids all the time, but sometimes they can be a little bit larger than what you were planning for.
Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, it's the size of them. So Webb is built to handle micrometeoroids, and it gets hit regularly. And that's just part of that's part of the game. And any spacecraft would get hit regularly by micrometeoroids, and that's taken into account in also the lifetime of. I mean, we heard a lot about lifetime of fuel, right? But also lifetime of the mirror and so on. Eventually it gets a lot of dings, just like a car, you drive a car for 10 years, you're going to have a few scratches on it. I mean, that's essentially what it is. But it'll take a lot of them before you really degrade performance. What was different with this one that everyone has heard a lot about is that it was bigger and or faster, some combination thereof. Than what was expected, than what you typically see. And obviously, the bigger it is, the faster it is, the more energy it hits with, and the greater impact relatively it will have. So this did have a significant impact in the budget for the kind of damage that micrometeoroids will just do over time. So that one, it did not cause any real measurable difference in performance of the observatory. But the concern is that if there are a lot of those big, fast ones, then over time, then that can affect performance. So it would degrade the observatory quicker than what was expected. And so folks are looking at this very carefully. They're going back, they're looking at the models, they're thinking about it, they're thinking of if there's anything that can be done to mitigate this if it turns out that those are more common than expected. And so they're going to come back with some answers for us, in the not too distant future, I expect. But so far, the hope is that this was like a freak event, that, a rare thing that, maybe once in a decade, and we don't have to worry about it. But if it's several a year, we may have to worry about it.
Could that, finding out about that and learning the profile of dust in the solar system and the size of it like that, could that affect future space telescope designs? For example, would we say, well, these things hit a lot, so we're going to protect this thing more and make it more like Hubble, sort of contained, as opposed to being out there, you know, open to the elements, so to speak, as JWST is?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, for those who've been following along, we'll know that the concept for what comes next may very well be something that that looks like the JWST design. You know, a bigger telescope that works in optical light, but is big enough that it would be able to go out and actually take direct images of Earth-like planets. But that would also have this big segmented mirror, bigger than probably about the same size as Webb's, and a sun shield. But in order to take direct images of real Earth-like planets, the surface of that mirror has to be even more precise than Webb's mirror. And Webb's mirror is already very precise. And that's where you have to start really worrying about micrometeorites, because the more precise that mirror has to be in order to image those Earth-like planets, the less it can withstand this kind of impact from micrometeorites. So you don't want to build this fantastic telescope that can observe Earth-like planets. You send it up and it only works for a few months because then it just gets hit by something.
That's interesting.
Yeah, so they're worrying about this. Sure.
Yeah, so that really shows that in addition to the science mission, Webb is also teaching us about the conditions of space for future telescopes, and will help define what we can actually do, in the future, especially with, giant telescopes like the next generation.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And if they end up having to put a big tube on it, first of all, it will be very expensive. And second of all, it may limit how big the telescope can be. So we hope not. So I hope they figure out, I'm sure they will figure out some clever way of dealing with it, but we'll see.
Well, at least we have the benefit of launch costs dropping and gigantic rockets coming that can launch things much, much bigger than Webb. And you don't really have to fold them up so much because of fairing sizes and everything else increasing. So this story is not over. There's going to be a whole series of increasingly great space telescopes coming. But Webb is the one that's going to show us everything it can now. Now, if you had to put numbers on it as far as power, how much more powerful, say as a percentage, is Webb versus Hubble? Now, I know that's a hard comparison to make because they're two different telescopes and two different areas of the spectrum. But if you just had to make a general statement about how much more powerful Webb is than Hubble, what would you put that number at?
Well, I would say it's orders of magnitude more powerful. Because orders of magnitude means, like 100, like much more than 10, but probably less than 1,000. And the reason you can say that, and because as you're right, that this is there are many parameters you can look at, as many many different ways you can compare things. But like, just if you look at, let's say, the example of the distant universe, with the earliest galaxies, we are more sensitive, even in the wavelength region where we overlap. We are far more, like 100 times more sensitive at more infrared, at redder wavelength, than anything that came before, which would be something like the Spitzer Space Telescope, for example. Like vastly better than
vastly that. Yes, as yeah. far as infrared and, telescopes, this is this right. is something much, much better than what we've ever had.
Right. But the thing is that it doesn't make as much, if this is a science goal, right, it doesn't make as much sense to compare to that bit of wavelength where you overlap with Hubble, because that's not where you see those distant galaxies. You see those distant galaxies in the area where we are much more sensitive than Spitzer. Right. So to do the science, we are 100 times better or something like that. Then we're faster because we have more pixels. Like one of the things you see in the images that was in the first images package, for example, Stefan's Quintet. This is a massive image. It's 150 million pixels. It was put together by almost 1,000 individual image files. And we're able to do that in just a few hours. So it's, and people have been saying in the past that on the web, you know, it's not a survey telescope. This is true. You know, it's not, you know, something that's going to look at the whole sky, but it can look at bigger regions and Hubble faster with more pixels on sky. And so that's another kind of power. And then there, you can think about the spectroscopy that you get. You know, so you have all this, you can't quantify that power, but the power that you can take an image and you see something weird there, something you don't understand, you know, whether that's, there's some direct imaging of exoplanets and you may see a blob there. You don't know exactly, is it a planet or not, or a distant galaxy? And you can go and take a spectrum of it and you'll just tell from that spectrum, yes, this is what it is. So that's a different kind of sort of soft power.
Now, in regards to the spectrum of the exoplanet where the water vapor was seen, did you see anything else? What other chemical signatures were in there, if any?
You can think of it as this, right? The composition of the atmosphere is just one thing you can learn about a planet when they do the spectra and they fit a model to it. There's one thing that comes out of that fit, but there are other things as well. So you're right. So there was clearly water there. We were looking at some other things, like at short wavelengths. You often expect to see atomic gas at very high altitudes in the planet, like potassium or lithium. And we think there may be some there, but it's something that requires a more careful reduction of the data. So this was something we just didn't have time to do before this release came. So folks are already looking at the spectrum to see if they can improve things. This is what you have to do when you're looking at this kind of precision. But other things as well, you get a temperature out, right? So this is over 1,000 degrees Kelvin. So you get that out of the spectrum. You get out that, in fact, it does have clouds. It was known as a cloudless planet because this is what Hubble said. Observations indicated, but they just weren't good enough to really say that, apparently, because once we have the web spectrum, we can clearly see that it has clouds. Other planets, you would be able to also look for volcanism or, you know, whether they have maybe an ocean on them, you might even be able to go look for variability over time, right? So it's kind of weather where, you know, maybe the atmospheric spectrum will change over time with seasons or not.
That's interesting because you could literally characterize the seasons and maybe even predict them ahead of time of an exoplanet. I mean, that's just mind-blowing that we can actually do that now.
Yeah. And so I think there's a lot of this kind of stuff is just going to come out. Oh, again, you know, give folks a little time, right? But, you know, over the coming months and years that they're going to, because the quality of the data are like that. So they open up discovery space. Right? They open up space to find things and that we didn't expect that we could do or that were there. Like the basic thing you need to do stuff like that is just quality of data. It's signal to noise. It's just resolution. It's sharpness. All that. And so we have all that. What we're showing with the spectrum is that we have that in just a single transit. So I think a lot of people are really excited about what we can do in the future for other planets and this planet too.
To sort of dig deep into this, just as a hypothetical, if we were able to get quality enough observations and the conditions and circumstances were just right, you could study a planet's seasons and derive all sorts of information from that, probably things like axial tilt, and start answering questions about, you know, Earth, you know, what, you know, how common is it of a stable axial tilt, you know, moderated by a moon? How common is that in the universe? And that really is sort of one question you could ask of JWST, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I think a lot of this is for JWST exoplanet observation is kind of really just limited by the available observing time. The main limitation is that for transits or eclipses, you know, where the planet goes behind the star instead of the other way around, is that it only happens a fixed number of times. The one we observed for the first images had a period of 3.5 days, which made it easy for us to schedule it. It wouldn't have worked if we had to wait a few weeks, right? We just wouldn't have had time to do it. But some of the most interesting planets, of course, have longer periods. You know, especially the ones that are cooler, that orbit farther from their star. So you have limited opportunities, and that's why it's actually great that we have much more than 5 years, more than 10 years, because it allows us to build up knowledge of planets with much longer periods than these hot Jupiters with just a few days to go around the star.
Now, people are going to ask me about the public access or availability of the data to the world's scientists. How does that work? What can anybody, you know, especially a scientist who knows how to interpret this, go and take a look at the JWST data and, you know, just have it free and clear out there for anybody of any country?
Ultimately, all JWST data will become completely public. There are some data sets that where the investigators get exclusive access time, we call it, of up to 12 months. But you'd be surprised of how much stuff that's just going to be public right away. So like your first images, we released all of that yesterday. So, you know, you can go right now and download it and, you know, have fun with it. Today we are releasing a lot of new public science data from the what's called the Early Release Science Program. Anybody who gets time to do what we call a large program, which has maybe more than 75 hours of observing time, that's also just public immediately. The solar system community got together and also decided that a lot of their data would just be public immediately. There's sort of this growing, I don't know if ideology is the right word, but you know, this is growing culture in the scientific community that data wants to be free, and we should not, individuals should not sit on exclusive data. The observatory is paid for by taxpayers of the world, right, or from many, many different countries. And so it really should be available to all. So I think you'll see there'll be a lot of that. And yes, for the public data, anybody can go to the archive and just go ahead and download it. It may take some work to understand it and figure it out. Trained scientists can do that best, but there's a lot of awesome amateur astronomers out there. And, you know, I would just encourage them to dig in and sure they will be able to do some awesome science or, you know, beautiful images or whatnot.
Even just something like the deep field image, you look in that, the hundreds of galaxies, there are some really interesting looking galaxies hidden in that image. So anybody can sort of go and look. And if you do that and you're looking at this little spiral galaxy or whatever, you're seeing, you're putting more attention into that galaxy than any other human ever has. Just by looking at it for a long time and admiring it, I find that pretty amazing.
Absolutely. And I happen to be so my role in making the first images. I worked with a team that did that, and I played a significant role. And one of the things I had to do in that role was, because of all the confidentiality about them, there was only one person who was able to download the data when they were available, and then to distribute it to the instrument scientists and the graphics artists who needed to deal with them. That was me. So I got to download that deep field one day when it was available, and just sit there and look at it for a couple of hours as the only person on Earth. And I will admit that was a weird feeling. Looking at all those galaxies as a first person, and I knew some of them would be more distant than what had been ever done before.
It's looking at the beginning of the universe. I mean, there few things are more weighty than that, you know, at the aftermath of the birth of the universe visible to us. So how does it work with regards to prioritizing observations now that we're in the science phase? Do you have like a ranking system on what gets done first versus what's second tier and things like that? Is there such a system, or is it more distributed?
Yes. Yeah, so we don't have a priority system. Everybody is equal with one exception, and that's that mentioned earlier, the what's called the early release science program, which is just in this first year. There's 500 hours of observations that were selected from the community. And these had the purpose of making sure that there was public data for all the important science modes of the observatory and over a wide range of science cases, so that even for those who didn't get time, or, you know, maybe there are students or postdocs who just came in later and want to ramp up and start doing science with the observatory, that there would be some data available for them. So those get priority, but they get priority because they're public data sets. And so we just want to make sure that they come out as quickly as possible within the first 5 months. Everything else has just this flat priority. The scheduling is made to make the observatory the most efficient possible. Right. So it's it takes time to move from one part of the sky to another, you know, more than half an hour if you're, you know, going from one part in the sky to the opposite part. And so it would be very inefficient if observations were scheduled according to some other priority than just, you know, making sure that we move as short distances on the sky as possible.
I see. And that also saves fuel, right? So if you sort of prioritize the targets near each other, you don't have to move the telescope as much, right?
Yeah. So, I think the fuel is a little more complicated, but it's taken into account as well. That's right.
Now, what's next? What can we expect in the coming month, say, from GWST? Is there going to be more pretty pictures coming out or anything like that? Or is it just going to be, we have to wait for the papers to be published?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. No, there'll be more pretty pictures. We certainly don't want to sit for months and not have something new come out. I do think that the science community will be very quick. I mean, it remains to be seen. I don't know if the first paper has been submitted yet or not, but we can take bets on when that will happen. But in the case that we're not getting some awesome results from the science community in the first few weeks here, then we are ready to we'll put out new images, and we'll do that regularly on a pretty frequent cadence.
And you mentioned on Twitter that there is such an image, at least one, and that there was another image taken that you didn't process or do anything with. You're obviously very busy getting the images that were out. But there is at least one other image out there that somebody could process and release at any time, right?
Yeah, I mean, you may be talking about that little bonus deep field. So that's available. There was another exoplanet as well in there, other than the one we used in the press release, and that's been released as well. I'm sure folks are looking at it. So yeah, I mean there'll be things.
And my last question for you, Klaus. All right, so we know of an exoplanet that's very close, Proxima B. Is that high on the list to take a look at?
Not to my knowledge. It's a hard target. It's very that's a bright. There's a bright star next to it, right? So I'm not sure, actually.
Yeah, that gets to be a problem when really, really closely orbiting exoplanets to red dwarfs. All right, Klaus. Well, congratulations. It was an absolute pleasure to watch the flawless deployment of JWST, and then now just the jaw-dropping images and science. It's going to be a great run.
Well, I'm sure. Yeah, we have a lot of good things to look forward to. So thanks for having me. It's always a blast.
Yep. And I hope you'll join us again at some point when even more science comes out. Accumulated science and talk of JWST.
Absolutely.